Gene, and to thank you to the Coast Guard for keeping Gene on the straight and narrow. Congratulations to Terry and to the new executive committee. From my standpoint, I say thank you for your continued confidence in my chairing this council. I will do everything I can to keep the council moving ahead and focused on what we determine to be the goals for this upcoming year, our priorities, which we will discuss towards the end of this meeting and vote on at our next meeting. I will continue right on into the report section. I am going to report on the executive committee meeting. That's under tab 1, and it is document number 3 is the report. I'm going to hit a few of these just quickly because a number of them will be discussed later on during the meeting. The timelines, the updated timeline is in the material, and on an ongoing basis that is on our website. You can find the updates that may happen in between the meetings online. The second item was legal guidance at the council meetings, and there was also a discussion on the lobbying issue. The executive committee decided upon a system which is outlined there, which I put under the category of control, tracking, and reporting mechanism for requests for legal advice. As far as the lobbying is concerned, that's been discussed with Gene. He would like is going to try and get somebody from, I think it's Commerce, a lawyer from Commerce who is an expert in this area to come to the November meeting to update us on that situation. The confidentiality proposed rule, you can see the comments that were made there. The letter is included in the package. And number 4 was the we fine-tuned the wording of the letter to the secretary on the groundfish disaster issue. That is also one of the enclosures in the package. We discussed some of the things that concerning the groundfish issue for 2013. The major changes that we were able to work on there have to do with staff changes that have been made to support work on the groundfish closed areas, the establishing the CATT. Did I get that acronym right? Oh, good. Don't ask me what it stands for, but it's Closed Area Technical Team?
Yes.
Oh, got it. And, okay, under item number 6 was the U.S.-Canada issue, and most of all of that will be discussed under the TMGC items on the agenda, which are tomorrow afternoon, I believe. Wednesday. Yes, they're the last items tomorrow. 7 is the discuss the priorities. That is going to be coming up also on the agenda. And one of the items that was discussed was the recommendation of rolling over the herring specs. I think there was a question that I'm not sure that we have had answered from the service was whether in fact we even had that ability to roll those over. And I don't know, George, if you have any further comment on that. And I may have just forgotten what our discussion was. No? Okay. Yeah. There was a discussion on the fisheries survival letter concerning yellowtail flounder and the assessment. There are a number of things that will be happening concerning that. One, I think we will get an update on under the regional administrator's report. There is going to be a workshop on the whole area of the retrospective biases or patterns. That is being done, I believe, by ICES. That is coming up. The Science Center is also doing work on the various models. The Ad Hoc Sturgeon Committee, we had a discussion concerning that. Basically, we will get the biop at some point in November, and at that point in time, that committee will get to work. And the last item was the discussion of limiting the time of speakers during the public comment period. At the council, we had discussed about the possibility of using the light timer system. I said that I felt it would be the chair's responsibility to oversee the length of time of any speaker, and I will try and do my best to keep those under control. So that's pretty much it for the executive committee. I'm happy to answer any questions. Doug.
Just to respond to your question concerning the hearing specs, as I understood it, the input I got as hearing committee chair was that the 2012 specs would stay in place in 2013 until replaced by the new specifications.
Thank you. David.
Item 6, regarding the U.S.-Canadian letters for Georgia's Bank Yellowtail Flounder. It indicates that Dan Morris stated it has been several years since the U.S.-Canadian agreement was approved, and now it's a good time to examine how well it is working. Was there any further discussion as to how that might proceed, how the service in particular might move this forward to determine how well it is working and whether revisions are needed?
That whole discussion item was brought up at the TMGC meeting. The initial reaction received from our Canadian counterparts who were there from the TMGC was negative. And part of that had to do with the fact that their feeling was that this was not an item for the TMGC itself to discuss. We brought it up mildly at the steering committee meeting. I think it may be an item that will get discussed at an intersessional meeting that is currently scheduled for sometime in February. There are a series of items that will be covered at that.
Okay, thank you. I hope indeed that does happen, and I also hope that this discussion regarding other stocks that might be subject for discussion with the Canadians to deal with some very difficult management issues and allocation issues, specifically sea herring. And when we get to the sea herring item on our agenda, we'll focus on that as well, maybe even during the listening session to provide the regional administrator with a suggestion as to how to move that forward. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, we will move on to the next, which is the executive director, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We normally have experimental fishery permits discussed, and at the time of doing the agenda, we didn't have any. We have a new one in. So where we've picked up some time, Mr. Chairman, I'd like Chris to discuss experimental fishery permits right under reports at the end, right after John Weber, if that's okay. For executive committee, we'll be meeting in October, so the new executive committee meetings, members will be getting out a poll to see when you're available to meet in October, discuss priorities and executive director position. We reinitiated planning for a two-day risk assessment workshop. It'll be in March, so you've probably gotten a doodle poll for that. We need to work with our SSC to resolve risk in our setting of ABC. We've been discussing that for a while, and we'll meet in March over 2 days. The NRCC is going to meet in November. Hopefully, they'll meet before our November Council meeting to discuss priorities. This is priority time of year, so we need to have a lively discussion about the many priorities we have and the limited resources we have to do them all. Since our last meeting, Rip and I have had a conference call with the IG auditor about the management review, and I think the report is due out by December, the initial report of the IG audit on management. And Rip and I also had a conference call or meeting with NIMS and Regional Administrator John and folks over at the region with the Touchtown contractor to review progress and how we're implementing the Touchtown Touchstone report, specifically the operating agreement. And we're moving forward with that. And you'll hear more of that probably at the November Council meeting after the Executive Committee meets to look at a review of the operating agreement. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Paul? Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering for the NRCC meeting, Paul, if we have an agenda that would be available. Perhaps it's not even out yet. But if the NRCC is going to talk about priorities, it does seem that it would be nice if the council had an opportunity to perhaps have some input as a group, at least be aware of what the discussion is.
Yes, thanks, Mary Beth. We post all the NRCC agenda and all the materials on our webpage, so that was a new thing, so you'll see it there. We're discussing priorities today, and we'll take what the council talks about today to the NRCC meeting in November. That's why hopefully it's before our council meeting in late November where we'll vote on priorities. Right now, there's some discussion if we'll be able to have it before our November 15th or 13th council meeting. So, but the purpose of today is to discuss priorities so that Rip and I have information and Terry to bring to the NRCC.
Anyone else? Thank you, Paul. We'll move on to the regional administrator, John.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations on your reelection. Went a lot smoother than any of mine. And to Terry on your election as vice chair, to the new executive committee members, to the new members of the council, and to all the members of the council, I also congratulate you on your powers of anticipation discussing an amendment to restrict the length of time for speakers, knowing that a former politician was going to be the new regional administrator. I think that's tremendous foresight. Also knowing that you had a state representative joining your midst, it's probably good having such a restriction on time for speakers. That's very, very foresighted. I'm new. Took office August 6th, so what am I in, week 8 or something? And don't worry, George Darcy is here, and He still has the nuclear code, so you're in safe hands. I'll make some introductory remarks, and there are familiar faces, familiar to me, and that gives me comfort that but there's some new faces too, so I will introduce myself. And George will give a report on activities because he and the staff at the regional office deserve credit for the work that's gone on, not me. And I'll get in the listening session that's later on today, go in more detail into what I've been doing in the last couple of months, reaching out and visiting with people in their places of work to find out how the fisheries service can be of service to fisheries, and that includes you, because we are of service to you, and I do want to hear how we can best work together. So I am new in that as regional administrator, just a, not even 2 months, but I have worked at NOAA before, as many of you know, running the first federal office of sustainable development in 1993 to 98, when I was a political appointee under President Clinton, working for Secretary Ron Brown, a great leader, the late Secretary Ron Brown. And we went through a fishery resource disaster back in the early 90s, 93. I thought that was tough then. There was a disaster declaration and economic assistance. That was my job to work with fishermen, with Capitol Hill, to try and figure out how we could tie the provision of economic assistance to work by you and your predecessor council, tighter restrictions in the form of Amendment 5 and Amendment 7, so that we could bring fish stocks back and ameliorate the economic pain that would accrue with the tighter restrictions. And I think it was an intelligent marriage of tighter restrictions and addressing the economic consequences of those restrictions. And now the situation seems to me, you all know, I'm not a scientist. I don't know what I am. I'm not even sure why they picked me for this job. I might have been the last person to withdraw my application. That's the best I can come up with. But at any rate, here I am. So you got to deal with it, and I've got to deal with it, and it's not a pretty picture. You know that better than I do. So there are tough decisions we've got to face, and we'll do it together with the best information we can come up with. I want to tell you that I am a tremendous fan of the Magnuson Act and the council form of making decisions. And as for the last 10 years, I worked for a Sea Education Association because it turns out graduates like Drew there, who's, and other smart people who go and make a better world because they have excellent professors like Professor Matt McKenzie here, who teach young people about the ocean. And so I've been kind of out of the loop, but as Matt and others can tell you, the Magnuson Act was revolutionary when you think of the early 70s and all the environmental legislation like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, which all had kind of a common theme, which is all wisdom resides in Washington. And it's a top-down, command and control, one-size-fits-all system of how we protect the environment. And in that era of the early 70s, Warren Magnuson said, wait a minute, we're going to do it very differently. We're going to set up a system that involves stakeholders and sets up ways of managing a resource that we're going to manage scallops different from herring, different from groundfish. We're going to do one thing in New England. We're going to do another thing in the Mid-Atlantic. We're going to do another thing in the Pacific Northwest. We're going to make it so complicated that you won't believe it. It's going to take forever. It's going to involve everyone. It's going to have everybody pulling their hair out. It's going to be so frustrating. It's going to be just like democracy. And that's what our system is, democracy. It's revolutionary. It's not the Clean Air Act. It's not the Clean Water Act. It's beautiful, right? I'm surprised any of you have anything, any hair on your head, right? And so this is an amazing law, this Magnuson Act. And like Winston Churchill said about democracy, it's the worst form of government there is, except for anything else. And you are the implementers of this amazingly beautiful Magnuson Act that is frustrating, but it is the best form of government except for everything else. And I can't imagine a better way to administer fisheries than the Magnuson Act, with you making all of these immensely complicated, interconnected decisions. Can you imagine one person in Washington or that one person's designee in Gloucester or any other regional office trying to make those decisions? So I am a fan of this law and these regional councils with the stakeholders, and I want to work with you, and I want to learn how to work with you. And I just honor Warren Magnuson. And the law can always be tweaked, it can always be made better, but fundamentally this law, again, think back to the 70s when it was invented in that climate. The council form of writing fishery laws is fundamentally genius, and I have a high regard for it. So before turning over to George for a report on the activities of the regional office, I do want to say I'm sorry that my counterpart, Bill Karp, took suddenly ill and missed this meeting. I'm not sorry that he's ill. I'm sorry that I didn't think of that excuse. No, I'm sorry that he's ill. Because he and I and Rip have been thinking about one of the issues that repeatedly comes up at the listening sessions that I've had, and that is this chasm that has been in existence forever, it seems, between fishermen and scientists. And I'm sure many of you have read David Dobbs' wonderful book, The Great Gulf, which stars our own Dave Gathel. Take a bow, Dave, will you? The Great Gulf between fishermen and scientists. And as Bill Karp says, Dr. Bill Karp, you know, fishermen have their tools for understanding the elusive truth of how many fish are in the ocean, and scientists have their tools of understanding that elusive truth. And they use different tools, and they speak a different language. It sounds like English, but it isn't. And you need, you know, the kind of earphones that you get at the UN to understand each other. And so there can be this chasm between fishermen and scientists. And when tough decisions have to be made that affect fishermen's pocketbooks, it can get tough. and messengers get frequently shot. And so we think it's important to try and do something to bridge that gap. And so Dr. Bill Karp, who has a sincere appreciation and respect for the way fishermen pursue that elusive truth, has thought that with other scientists not employed by the government, and with the council, you, and with the regional office, we might invest some time on November 9th in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm not sure where yet other than Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We might spend a day reaching out with fishermen and scientists to look at groundfish and how we do science in counting groundfish and what does that science tell us, and conduct that in the English language so that even I, your regional administrator, might understand it, and allow enough time for question and answer and suggestions. Boy, if I, you know, every meeting I go to, I get criticized about the new ship, the Bigelow. And many of the sessions, Bill's been with me at some of the sessions, but not at others. And so I think when you put fishermen and scientists in the same room together, you get a lot more progress and a lot more exchange of information, and it's useful. And I think the council has a role to play in this, so that Rips and Paul have been at a number of these planning meetings. And so I want to let you know that we're going to do a lot of outreach on this. We're not going to solve the problem in one day's time, but I think it'll be a good investment of a day. And we're going to look forward to you reaching out to people on the 9th. That's a Friday. And I wish Bill were here, because really he's the lead on this. And it's his idea, but I wanted to let you know that, that's in the works. Senator Kerry is in the news today about asking us to do that, and it's an idea that Senator Kerry has been proposing for a long time, and so we're working closely with his office on that. But I wanted to let you know that's in the works, and it's not too far off, a little more than a month, so you'll get a lot more information soon on that. So with that, let me turn it over to George Darcy for the activities of the regional office since your last get-together. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, John. I've got a number of updates for the council, primarily having to do with groundfish activities. Not surprisingly, we are beginning our activities for the 2013 fishing year, groundfish fishing year, and as a start to that, we have received a total of 18 sector applications. We've got their operations plans and contracts for fishing year 2013, which we will be reviewing. Those include all previously granted exemptions and a number of new exemption requests that we'll be looking at. At-sea monitoring programs are required for the 2013 operating plans and were submitted as part of those plans. And the sector rosters are due to us by December 3rd, 2012. Speaking of sector exemption requests, we have one that we're processing for a targeted redfish fishery. I think the council's pretty well aware of that. We are preparing the proposed rule that would expand on a previously approved sector exemption by allowing sector trawl vessels to harvest redfish using nets with cod ends with mesh as small as 4.5 inches. Another sector exemption request that came before the council recently is for special access program access. Back in 2011, we received several sector exemption requests for the exemptions from the seasonal restrictions of Eastern U.S. Canada area haddock special access program and the closed area 2 yellowtail flounder haddock SAP. We did disapprove them in the 2012 sector final rule because we were unclear at that time as to the council's intent as to whether it was acceptable to allow an exemption under Amendment 16 for those SAPs. But at your June meeting, if you recall, you did clarify your intent on those programs and recommended that we do grant access to the two SAPs, and we're currently going forward with analyzing and implementing that action. Immediately following the end of my report, Travis Ford on my staff is going to give the council a brief presentation on a spiny dogfish exempted fishery. If you remember, you had a similar presentation at the June council meeting about the skate exempted fishery. Under the regulations, we have to consult with the council on these exempted fisheries, and this will constitute that that consultation. So at the end, Travis will come up and give you that presentation. I'm sure you all remember that on May 1st, we made effective an interim final rule using interim authority of the Secretary to implement Gulf of Maine cod measures for FY 2012. That initial rule expires on October 29th, and we are working on an extension of that rule that would carry that through the remainder of the fishing year. Filing today and publishing tomorrow is an in-season rule to make fishing year 2011 year-end adjustments. Among the things that are in that rule, we will be adjusting the differential days at sea rate for common pool vessels based on the final 2011 sector and common pool catch information. And it will update the 2011 catch estimates for other components of the groundfish fisheries, such as exempted fisheries, non-groundfish vessels, and state-only permitted vessels. Updating you on this year's activity through September 17th on days at sea leasing, we have processed a total of 5 leases for the common pool and 93 for sectors. Of those, all 5 common pool leases were approved. 72 of the sector leases were approved. The total number of days at sea leased to date have been 72.3 for the common pool, 2,509.3 for sectors. And the average cost per day at sea leased for common pool is $122.90, and for sectors, $9.91. An update on the sector ACE transfers. To date, we have processed a total of 573 transfers, amounting to a total of 9.6 million pounds. The 3 stocks that have been the majority of those transfers are Georges Bank, Cod West, Pollock, and White Hake. And finally, we have determined that 90% of the total allowable landings for the northern Red Hake have been landed, and effective September 20th, the northern Red Hake possession limit was reduced to 400 pounds for the remainder of the fishing year. And that applies to the northern Red Hake stock area, which covers the Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank exemption area. So that concludes my report. And as I said, we will follow up with an expanded report on the proposed spiny dogfish exempted fishery by Travis.
Thanks, George. I'm Travis Ford. I work at the regional office. And as George said, what I'm going to do is brief you on an exempted fishery that we're going to be proposing in the next couple of weeks here. So the regional administrator has the authority to grant an exempted fishery, provided that what it's exempting them from is the multi-species regulations. So provided that a fishery, when being enacted, lands less than 5% multi-species. So we talked about this earlier at the June Council meeting about the skate bait fishery, where fishermen are out targeting skate bait when normally they'd have to be on a groundfish day at sea, on a groundfish trip. But when they're catching less than 5% multi-species, they don't. The regional administrator has the authority to exempt them from the requirements of the multi-species fishery. So we received two different exempted fishery requests from sectors. The real benefit to being exempted from these requirements is that if you're on a trip targeting dogfish, normally you have to be on a multi-species trip. So if you're in a sector, you'd have sector discard rates applied to that trip. If you're in the common pool, you'd have to be on days at sea. And so all the other restrictions involved with the multi-species fishery. We had two requests from sectors to exempt different types of gear: gillnet gear, longline gear, and handline gear, in statistical areas 521, 514, and 515 year-round. Obviously, when we go and analyze that, you can catch more than 5% multi-species with those gears during those times. But what we did do is when we looked at the entire request, we did find a smaller area off the coast of Cape Cod where people using those gears were not catching over 5% multi-species. So what NMSA is going to be proposing in the next few weeks here is an exempted fishery for vessels targeting spiny dogfish off the coast of Cape Cod using gillnet gear, longline gear, from June through December. In addition, we're going to exempt handline gear, or proposing to exempt handline gear, from June through August. Basically, outside of those restrictions, we had either no data in the area involved or trips that were exceeding the 5% multi-species threshold. So for a vessel to participate, unlike a sector exemption, this is open to all vessels. So essentially, you would need a spiny dogfish permit. And then if you had a VMS unit, you would just declare out a fishery, and you could go out there and target spiny dogfish. You're still subject to the spiny dogfish trip quota, and then also that's also managed by the annual quota for spiny dogfish. So that's what NMSA is proposing. And as George mentioned, we have to consult with the council on it. So that's what this represents, and I'd be happy to field any questions regarding it.
Thanks very much. And, you know, sort of to be clear, I work out on Cape Cod with a lot of the fishermen who are pursuing this exemption. I understand I could see a reason for the gillnet and long line being bound by June to December, but I don't understand how there's any lack of evidence demonstrating that you can't catch any ground fish with jig and hand gear outside of June and August. I mean, you can't go within 30 miles of Chatham, you can't catch anything but dogfish with hand gear.
So I agree. It seems counterintuitive. Handline gear would seem, or jigging would seem, like the most conservative of those types. However, basically our data is based on observed trips. And we had several observed trips in the months of September, October, November that caught more than 5% groundfish. The primary species was cod. So what I can tell you is a couple of things. One, with handline trips, most of the guys doing it are hand gear A or hand gear B guys. And if that's the case, then they're not really the restrictions aren't as binding. They don't get a sector discard rate. They don't have days at sea. So they'd still be able to go out and have a handline trip on a hand gear A or hand gear B permit. If you were in a sector or in the common pool, though, you would still have to you'd have to be on a declared groundfish trip for those months.
Tom, follow up.
Yeah, I'm still concerned by that. I'll have to dig in on the observed trips and what the catch was. I still find it very hard to believe that we can't justify an exemption past August for those gears. I'll probably also have some comments about the gillnets and long lines and the window there, but I think that's at least somewhat more reasonable. Do you have, you said that it wasn't, you know, the NIMS proposal won't have the full requested stat areas. Do you have a document showing what the area will be?
So in the proposed rule, we're going to have an EA to go along with that. And in the very beginning of the EA, we show the original request, and it's one of the alternatives that was considered but rejected based on the large amount of trips exceeding 5%, the 5% multi-species threshold in all the areas. And when you look at that, when you see that in the EA, you can see, you know, what we did is we had all the trips a lat long with and it's a different color depending on the amount of the percentage of multi-species caught, and you'll see these this grouping of trips under 5% right in the area that we're exempting. But when you look at it over the larger area, there's just tons of trips scattered in that catch greater than 5% mults. But it's a proposed rule, so you know we'd encourage you to comment on it.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, thank you. My agency will take a close look at the proposed rule. Obviously, we have a great interest in spiny dogfish in Massachusetts, and my agency has, for quite a long time now, been very aggressive with our management of the dogfish fishery inside state waters. It's unclear to me that the requests from the sectors for this particular exemption, was it for everywhere in the Gulf of Maine, backside of the Cape, and then you were selective in terms of your evaluation of the data and you resulted then and just off the Cape? Was it everywhere except for that spot?
So the request from the different sectors was for statistical areas 521, 514, and 515, which is a significant portion of the Gulf of Maine.
Good.
So that's the query that we ran with our observer data. We pulled all gillnet, longline, and handline trips in those three statistical areas. And I think that's probably part of the reason that Tom's having issues with it too. Those were the requirements. They had to be in that statistical area. They had to be using one of those three gear types, and it had to be on a declared on a multi-species trip, because these are the trips that we're exempting. So target species isn't part of the query, because that's not data that we rely on, because it's coming from an observer. It's just suggested by the captain to the observer, and they write it down. Further, we want to be sure that you can't put this gear in the water in that area and catch greater than 5% multi-species. So in that sense, the target doesn't matter as much. And that's about why the query was run the way it was. But, yes, all of those areas.
Okay. And with our Massachusetts rules, we make it clear to the fishermen that there can be no overnight sets. They're supposed to be strike sets. In other words, the dogfish is so abundant, they know where they are. They set the hooks or they set the gill nets, and very quickly they pull the nets and pull the hooks because the dogs are there and they're caught quickly. No bycatch. Or very, very little bycatch occurs as a result of that. Did the request that came to the service provide any specific time of day? In other words, were they going to go with that sort of a strategy to allow them maximum flexibility, that is, to promote more areas and more times for the taking of dogfish? I would have hoped that they would have done that. If they're fishing gillnets overnight, then I can see why your data set would show there's a problem. So did they make that kind of a request?
There was no specific request on the soak time for the gill nets or any of the gears.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I think Dave Pierce raises a good point. I think that probably should be a requirement. There was number one. I have three other items. Will you need pingers on the gill nets? I mean, part of this is in the fall when harbor porpoises are there.
Yeah, I mean, you're still all the gear requirements remain the same, you know, for having the gill nets.
Okay. Will you be allowed to retain groundfish, or is this going to be zero possession?
Zero possession of groundfish.
Okay.
It's an exempted. You're not on a declared groundfish trip.
So
you can't retain it.
Okay. And then my last question is, because these are not monitored fisheries now, how will you know really what they are catching? I mean, do you still plan to monitor the fisheries?
So it would be just like the regular NEFOP observer observer rate, but there would, but they would lose the, you know, the requirement, the further requirement that the ground fish fishery requires.
So they won't have the pre-trip notification, the two-day, all that stuff that, okay.
Correct.
So it'll just be going down the dock and saying, are you going dog fishing today? And
yep.
I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Will they, but they still will be required to carry observers if asked, right?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else on this report?
Okay.
Thank
and like
you.
I said, the proposed rule will be out shortly, and we'd encourage you all to comment if you have suggestions.
Questions for George? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for you, George, about the upcoming Harbor Porpoise consequence closure. With the effective date less than a week from now, I haven't seen much outreach out to the industry, and a lot of small boats, conceivable safety issues with weather. I was thinking it might be helpful to get for protected resources to work with the folks in the docks just to get help get the notice out, prevent any additional compliance problems.
So, as you know, Terry, we've had lots of meetings with the industry on the closure, which is scheduled to go into effect October 1. And we continue to evaluate the request for a delay until February and March. And at a meeting we had on Friday in Gloucester, we promised that we would make a decision tomorrow. And so we intend to do that, and with your indulgence, we will announce that decision here tomorrow at after lunch at 1:15. And so if you have thoughts on that, we're always willing to hear advice.
No, I'm just concerned in our mutual effort to provide outreach to industry that it doesn't fall between the cracks. So thank you.
Oh, it's not falling between any cracks, Terry.
Dave Cato.
I want to back up what Terry said. I saw the weather this morning, and it said rainy and breezy for Saturday and Sunday. Now, that probably means a northeaster, perhaps. I don't know. I didn't see anything else. But these netters, if they have to bring their gear in, they can't, you know, they're going to need 4 or 5 days' notice here. So in order to gather the gear up, I don't want to see people out there in the middle of a northeaster on September 30th worried about which is worse, being out of compliance or drowning. The second question I had was for George. On the sector exemption request, George, will those only apply to the sectors that have requested them, or if they are granted, will they apply to all sectors?
I think they'll be available to any sector that wants to request them. Travis is saying yes.
Dave Pierce.
Hey, George, in your summary, you mentioned the sector operations plans, and you mentioned at-sea monitoring, and those operations plans have addressed at-sea monitoring. We all know what's in store for 2013. Do you recall what exactly the sectors did say in their plans regarding how they would implement the 2013 at-sea sampling program?
No, to be honest, I haven't seen them yet, but my staff who are reviewing them will be here, so I'm sure that they can fill you in on that when they do come.
Anything else for George? Okay, thank you, George. Thank you, Travis. Thank you, John. We'll move on to Gene, General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To bring you up to date on some of the litigation. On September 5th, the oral arguments were heard by the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston on the lawsuit brought by various industry members, New Bedford, Gloucester, and others, challenging Amendment 16. As you recall, the agency won on all counts at the district court level. with respect to this amendment and various parties, including New Bedford, Gloucester, and other fishing industry groups, appealed to the First Circuit that decision. The court at the appellate hearing only allowed fairly limited oral arguments to be held in that case. We don't have a specific date as to when the court will decide its appeal. It's, you know, some people are saying maybe around 3 months, but there's no way of predicting how long the court will take to hand down its decision. So we are waiting that decision, and of course we'll report back once that decision is handed down. In the lawsuit challenging Amendment 4 to the herring plan, Flaherty versus Blank, I reported on that last time. This is a decision or a challenge that focused in part on whether river herring should have been included as a stock in the fishery for herring. The court held that NIMS did not satisfy its obligation to independently determine whether Amendment 4's definition of stocks in the fishery, particularly with respect to river herring, complied with the Madison-Stevens Act. The court held also that NIMS did not adequately consider whether Amendment 4 complied with National Standard 9's requirement to minimize bycatch to the extent practicable, and that NIMS violated NEPA by failing to consider environmental impacts of a reasonable range of alternatives for acceptable biological catch control rule, accountability measures, and measures for minimizing bycatch. The court upheld the approval of Amendment 4 in connection with setting of ACLs and AMs. And the court at the time it handed down this decision did not specify a remedy to reflect its decision. Instead, the court asked the parties to suggest an appropriate remedy. The parties in the lawsuit tried to come to an agreement on that but did not do so. So instead, each party independently provided to the court suggested remedies with respect to the decision. There's a letter that the agency sent in partial fulfillment of the remedial order in that case that came down on August 5th, I believe, August 2nd, that outlines essentially what the remedial order required and what the National Marine Fisheries Service is recommending to the council to do in response to that remedial order. And Paul, is that letter in the binder, I presume, or not? This is the August 31st letter to Rip Cunningham, but it is in the binder, probably under the herring section. Yeah, so it's under the herring tab, which is tab what? 5. But so this outlines in more detail sort of the results of the remedial order that the court handed down and what NIMS expects or is requesting the council to do. Now, we can probably, should we wait until we get to the hearing? It'll take a little while to go through this. I think it might be make more sense to go through this letter and what the agency is requesting NIMS to do in connection with that order at the time that we do herring. But if you want to get a preview, you can look at that letter in under tab 5.
Just FYI, it is noticed in the agenda as one of the items under herring, so
okay.
We will keep
so
it
we'll
there.
Do it then. Another update in connection with the Western Sea lawsuit, which challenged Amendment 1 to herring, specifically the permit splitting provision in Amendment 1 that prohibited splitting of permits to qualify for the new limited access herring permit that was created by Amendment 4. The court found in favor of the plaintiffs on that provision, holding that in light of the particular facts of the case, that it was not appropriate for NIMS to approve the permit splitting prohibition, which essentially means that vessels could take permit histories from more than from another vessel and combine it onto a vessel that has qualified for limited access permits based on third or fourth party vessel histories. So that means that limited access, a boat could be eligible to get a limited access herring permit on its vessel, even though it may have used another vessel's history to qualify, for instance, a groundfish limited access permit. The agency initially appealed this decision, but in the meantime entered into settlement negotiations with the plaintiffs on this lawsuit. And in the last few weeks, a settlement agreement was reached between the agency and the plaintiffs, and the appeal was dismissed based on that settlement agreement. That settlement agreement essentially specifies that NMFS would issue a permit to one of the plaintiff vessels in light of the court's holding, because it would qualify for that permit if the permit splitting prohibition was not in place. It also specified that another vessel owner that had put his vessel into CPH certified permit history would also be eligible to apply when the vessel is taken out of CPH for apply and receive a limited access herring vessel. So the settlement agreement then basically allows for two additional vessels to enter into the fishery according to the court order. I might also remind the council that we're in the remand phase for a couple other lawsuits brought by Oceana. Oceana sued the agency with respect to Amendment 16, in part claiming that there were not adequate accountability measures for certain stocks that were not allocated specifically to sectors. Instead, there was a zero possession limit issued for those stocks. And the court found that the accountability measure for those stocks was not adequate and remanded to the agency to develop adequate accountability measures. And that is something that's an ongoing process right now with the council and with respect to Framework 48 to develop those accountability measures. The other case that has been remanded to the agency involved the court's finding and a challenge to the SBR, or actually it's an appellate court reversal of a court finding with respect to the SBRM, the Standardized Bycatch Reporting Methodology Omnibus Amendment. The court found the district court found that the amendment was sufficiently justified. The appellate court found that the option for National Marine Fisheries Service to create an exemption for meeting the minimum requirements for observer coverage if there wasn't adequate resources available was not satisfactorily justified, so remanded the omnibus, basically vacated the SBRM omnibus amendment and remanded it back to the agency to develop a standardized bycatch reporting methodology that did not have this particular defect. That's being developed by an FMAT team of various members of the Mid-Atlantic and New England councils and the staff of the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Science Center. So that's an ongoing process that will, you know, we're encouraging you to give attention to so that we can address the remand given to us by the court. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Gene? Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, you see in the letter in the lawsuit it talked about stocks in a fishery, river herring and shad, and I asked for legal determination about what does stock in a fishery mean. In other words, we treat river herring now as a bycatch. It's not a stock in the fishery, but we consider it in our plan under National Standard 9. and I asked for legal determination or policy on a stock in a fishery. Does that mean it needs an ACL, it needs habitat, essential fish habitat determinations, it needs ABCs, and you go the whole route? So could you respond to that? What stock in a fishery means?
Yes, that's exactly what it means. If it's a stock in the fishery, it's subject to all the requirements of the Madison-Stevens Act, including those with respect to ACLs and AMs.
Anyone else, Regine? Dave Gaethel.
On the limited access lawsuit, what repercussions does this have for other limited access programs? I mean, is this going to allow people to come in every limited access program we have and say, I established my history over here and now I got this boat and I want a permit?
No, it's limited to the facts and the particular fishery management plan that was at issue, i.e. the Atlantic herring plan. The court did not say that by definition all permit splitting prohibitions are invalid. It just said in this particular case, given the circumstances and the administrative record, that it was not valid for the Atlantic herring limited access fishery.
Anyone else for Gene? Peter.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so does that, I mean, Dave was trying to bring that out to groundfish or something else for other limited access, but does that open the door in the herring for other boats to come?
Well,
or is that just specific to that case?
Yes, we're looking into that now to see whether there are other similarly situated Atlantic herring limited access permit applicants that may have been in the exact same position as the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. The lawsuit itself did not require us to grant permits or to give opportunities to these other possibly similarly situated vessel owners, but it did not prohibit it either. And so we are looking at that and have indicated that we plan to treat other similarly situated permit applicants consistent with the lawsuit. So it may allow others to come into the fishery if they are in the same position as the plaintiffs, which would be something we'd have to determine on a case-by-case basis.
Anyone else for Gene? Okay, I think what we'll do is we will take our 90-minute break at this point. Let's come reconvene at 10:50. Center, but while people are still filing back into the room, I'm going to give you a moment's reprieve, Jim. And a couple of other housekeeping issues. One, I will try and say your name when I call on you. And this is primarily for the webcasting of this meeting so that people understand who it is that is talking. if I, and I will, I know from time to time, forget to mention your name, please say your own name. And it helps them understand who is talking. Also, at everyone's seats are the forms for requests for committee assignments. If you can get those filled out and back to Karen, that would be great. And I had received a question on what is the status of the executive director search. Essentially, we have received 26 applications for the executive director position. The search committee, if that's what you want to call it, essentially has been the executive committee, and with the changes that were made, Jim going off, et cetera, we didn't have enough people, in my opinion, to move ahead with looking at the applications. I wanted to wait until the new executive committee was appointed, and so we will begin that process of selecting a maximum of 10 candidates that the search committee will interview, and then the search committee will select the final three candidates, which will come before a closed meeting of the voting members of this council for the final interview and selection process. If anybody has any questions on that, I'm happy to answer them, but that's the update of where we are. And I have notified or sent out a notification to all of those candidates explaining to them sort of where we were in the process, that we had not forgotten them, because some of them have submitted their application quite some time ago. Okay. I will now turn it over to Jim Weinberg from the Science Center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The report that I'll be giving, I'll be covering a diverse array of topics today. I'll start off by mentioning Dr. Karp. He was planning to come to the meeting, but called me very early in the morning because he is ill, and perhaps he will be here tomorrow or the next day. I don't know yet. And if he does appear, I'm sure he'll be able to comment on this meeting that was mentioned by John Bullard this morning about November the 9th to discuss groundfish. In addition, Dr. Karp was scheduled this afternoon after lunch to give a description of the 5-year strategic plan that the center has. And rather than have me just talk what's on the PowerPoint, we both felt that it would be better for the center director to actually describe that in his own words. So I think that we'll be asking you to schedule that for a future council meeting. I'd like to give a short description of what the survey vessels are doing currently, and then I'll talk about stock assessments, talk a little about the sea scallop peer review that is being planned, and then the National Bycatch Report. So first of all, the surveys. The 2012 shrimp survey was conducted from July the 1st through August the 18th, and all of the stations were completed successfully. The 2012 clam survey took place on an industry vessel for the first time in August, from August the 3rd through the 18th, and it was aboard the ESS Pursuit out of Atlantic City, New Jersey. And the autumn multi-species bottom trawl survey began on September the 5th. Leg 1 was completed on September the 20th, and leg 2 has departed on September the 24th. The herring acoustic survey is underway. It began on September the 3rd, and it's being conducted on the FSV Pisces, and it will be returning on September the 29th. on stock assessments. We're very busy at the center doing stock assessments. The one that's upcoming is SARC 55 will be the two cod stocks. Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod are both scheduled for reviews of benchmark assessments, and the meeting will take place in Woods Hole on December the 3rd through the 7th. And that will be through our the standard SAWSARC process, with independent reviewers coming in and reviewing these benchmark assessments. The working groups that do these that conduct the stock assessments have been very busy. They're being chaired by Robert O'Boyle, who's a member of the New England Council's SSC. They've already had one meeting, and they have two additional meetings scheduled. And all of these working group meetings are open to the public. And Mr. O'Boyle has a long email list, so he's gone out of his way to notify the public about these working group meetings, and the attendance is open for all of them. In addition to these COD meetings that will be reviewed in December, there is a SARC that has been planned for February, and this is out of the ordinary to have an additional SARC between December and June. But through discussions with the councils and at the NRCC, it was decided that there would be this additional SARC to review benchmark assessments of White Hake and Atlantic Surf Clam. And that meeting is scheduled for February the 19th to the 22nd. Then the June SARC, which will be SARC 57, will be with striped bass and summer flounder. In addition to that, there is going to be a benchmark stock assessment through the track process on Eastern Georges Bank cod, and that will, I don't know the exact dates for that, but it will probably be sometime around February, March. Then moving in further towards the spring, there will also be track assessments of the Eastern Georges Bank haddock and Georges Bank yellowtail, followed by the center doing all of the standard updates of the mid-Atlantic stocks, such as bluefish, black sea bass, scup, fluke, etc. So the center is very committed at the moment to cranking out all of these assessments, and there's a lot of activity with the stock assessment working groups right now to perform all these analyses. Then a few words about the National Bycatch Report. This is a general topic, not just specific to our region, but the National Marine Fisheries Service is beginning the process of updating the first edition of the National Bycatch Report, which was published in September of 2011. So a steering committee has been appointed to provide guidance on developing the second edition of the report. And our own Dr. Paul Rago is the steering committee member for the Northeast region. And the National Bycatch Report contains a lot of information for all of the federally managed commercial fisheries with federal data collection programs. And the kind of information it contains are bycatch estimates for all the fish stocks and protected species, as well as comprehensive documentation of the data sources for bycatch and the analytical estimation methods. So I think that there will be additional reports at future council meetings on how this is going. But at the moment, I think the plan is to have an online update of this report come out in 2013, and then every 2 years there will be additional updates of this report. And in 2017, they're planning to have a comprehensive report. And so every 6 years, there will be these large comprehensive reports, and every 2 years, they'll have updates. So that's everything I know about the National Bycatch Report. Now, a few words about the scallop review. That may come up again when scallops come up on the agenda, but I'll just mention the progress that we've made thus far. You'll recall that last spring the council had a lot of discussion about the HABCAM system that the center was proposing to use in the survey this summer. And the Science Center then came back to the council, and there was a lot of discussion, and the center proposed, and the council agreed, to have the Science Center do a CIE type of review of all of the systems that are used in the scallop assessment to collect survey data. So this includes the SMAST, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and VIMS. They all have research programs collecting survey data with different methods that go into the scallop assessment. So to get this started then, the first step was Paul Howard or Rip, I believe, had sent a memo to Dr. Karp asking that your SSC have input into the terms of reference. So at one of the September New England Council SSC meetings, your SSC was given the draft terms of reference, and they are going to comment on these and provide comments back to the Science Center about the terms of reference. In addition to that, on September the 19th, Dr. Karp sent a formal letter out to SMAST, HUI, and VIMS describing in general terms that this review was being planned and the purpose of the review, and asking that each of these institutes, asking for their cooperation and willingness to participate in the review. And once we hear back from each of the institutions, then the next step will be to engage all of the parties in setting the final terms of reference, figuring out who the reviewers will be, because there's a fairly broad spectrum of technologies here. So to get a qualified review panel, each of the parties involved will have to make suggestions about who is qualified to actually review this work, because we're talking about optics and camera systems and remote vehicles. I think you get the message. So there's still a lot of preparation to do. And the final thing I'll mention about this is the dates when we think that this review will occur. It will be probably in late March of 2013 or early April. And that concludes my report. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, but if Dr. Karp were here, I think he'd be able to field some of the higher-level questions. And if I can't do that, then I'll have to defer and try to get back to you. Thank you.
Questions for Jim Weinberg, Tom Dempsey, and then Laura, did you have your hand up? Oh, sorry. Laura, and then David Pierce.
I just had a question on the fall survey trials that have been going on, or I think a second one is about to happen. Are we doing any side-by-side trawling with the industry, as has been sort of recommended, to create more buy-in with the industry in terms of belief, specifically perhaps side-by-side with boats outfitted to catch the yellowtail with the appropriate gear?
The short answer to that is I don't think there is any side-by-side towing ongoing during this survey, and I'm not exactly sure if what plans are in the works to do that sort of work. And I'll simply repeat that a lot of I know there's been a lot of criticism of the Bigelow, and while the new survey gear was being developed, there were actually years of deliberations and a lot of input both from academic people and fishermen in developing the new gear. And then there was an extensive calibration experiment that took place side by side between the Bigelow and the Albatross. So it's not as though this has never been considered. When transitions are made, it's always good to do more to try to bridge the gap between survey vessels. But in this case, I think we did what we could with the time and resources that were allowed to us. And in terms of going forward, then I'd have to speak with other people to really get you a good answer.
David Pierce.
Yeah, Jim, regarding the review of all of the methodology for assessing sea scallop abundance, I think you said that you're going to ask all of the institutions to cooperate, that Bill Karp has done that, which is great. Did you say that the institutions, HUI, SMAST, and others, that they would also be involved in reviewing the terms of reference to see if they agree with those terms of reference too?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. I really appreciate what the Center has done on this effort. It's a great initiative on the Center's part. It's very consistent with what this Council has requested. So thank you very much for all the effort you're putting into this.
Mark Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, I have two questions. First, with regard to the herring acoustic survey, we were presented with the results of the updated herring assessment at the committee last week. We found again that the acoustic biomass estimates are not used in the stock assessment model because of divergent trends, I guess, inconsistent with the body of data. I'm wondering, is the what information is coming out of that survey that's useful? Is it not going to be used in stock assessment? Is the Center having some consternation about continuing the expense of that survey? Could it better be utilized elsewhere?
Well, thank you. This is a question that I certainly expected to come up from someone who's really paying attention to the herring assessment. And I believe at the moment that the plan is they're doing the herring acoustic survey right now, but I think that it's not funded at the moment for the coming year. And the plan is to take a year off to reevaluate the methods that are used in this survey to possibly change how it's done and basically a breather to reevaluate. So we're doing exactly what it addresses your concern that we're not blindly going out there and continuing to do something that isn't working. And so there will be a period of reevaluation that is planned.
One more on the Shark 55. Yep, the Gulf of Maine cod assessment. Could you remind me what new sources of information that is, in the catch stream and the survey data is going to be available for that, and what new or alternative conventions are going to be explored? Coming on the heels of an assessment not that long ago.
After the stock assessment was completed last December, the SFC had a lot of involvement with recommending what the new terms of reference should cover. And one of them is whether the landings per unit of effort in the commercial fishery is a valid index of abundance of the population. So there has been some work on that. The utilization of the new MRIP recreational data. There's one other thing that is being incorporated. Then one other topic that's more of a long-range one is the stock structure definition. And there's been a lot of discussion at the SSC, and there was a meeting at GMRI to discuss this three-phase basically a three-phase project whereby if the stock structure should be redefined and if the biology warrants that, then that's the first step. And the second and third steps actually involve making the decision to change the stock structure, and then the third one is to implement this at the council level. This summer there was a workshop that was led by Dr. Anila at GMRI, and they had a very good discussion and talked about the genetics and so forth. Unfortunately, the meeting, like a lot of science meetings, was not completed. And the final steps in terms of actually deciding if stock structure should be changed, although there were indications that there were, reasons to change it, the bottom line of that report is that there was still more work to do. In addition, the Canadian scientists who should play a big role in this whole decision were not at that meeting. So before changes are made to the COD stock structure definition, we'd certainly have to involve Canadian scientists. And then moving on to those additional steps, you would also have to be thinking about the co-management of COD and how if you were to change the lines that define the COD stocks, how the Canadians would interact with you in that. So I know that I'm leaving out one other new topic that is being considered in the assessment, but it's just escaping my mind at the moment.
The other topic was hook discard mortality.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, there was a call to reevaluate the discard mortality estimate that was being used for COD. So there was a one-day meeting held. Earl Meredith from the Science Center was the chairman of that meeting, and I believe they did come up through an expert opinion approach. There were fishermen involved as well as scientists, and they came up with a better estimate of what the discard mortality rate probably is. And that is being incorporated into the stock assessment by the working group.
Dave Gaisel. And Mary Beth, you're the last. We've got to...
Okay, I had two questions. One is this is probably one for Dr. Karp, the follow-up from the GMRI meeting. We did have, as a member of the working group, we did have a very specific request to complete phase one, and I have not heard anything to indicate that any action's been taken. So perhaps you could check with him on that. And my other question was on the stock boundary issue and these two assessments. I know the working group discussed it on, I think it was August 28th, the stock boundary issue, but since they're, and this is just kind of a general question, since they're still considered two separate stocks at the moment, or, you know, the boundaries are what they are at the moment, how or who will determine how that stock boundary issue is raised across these two assessments? Will it be Dr. O'Boyle? Will it be the entire SARC? Or, you know, basically, who has the say as to whether or not those issues enter into this current round of stock assessments?
Well, the guidance that the SARC will follow comes from their terms of reference, and the terms of reference for the meeting were set in June, before the stock structure meeting was held at GMRI, and that's kind of the result of having two trains leave the station at the same time. The people wanted to have the benchmark assessments of COD this December, but a whole another group of people also wanted to go forward with the stock structure ID. And in my mind, a logical way to proceed would have been to figure out what stock structure you want to have, then go ahead and do your stock assessments. But that was not in the cards. And so what is occurring is the stock assessments were planned back in the spring. The terms of reference were set. And the term of reference that refers to the to stock structure is quite narrow. And it says to basically acknowledge the work that is was accomplished in the in that meeting this summer. But it's not calling for them to open up a discussion of whether the boundaries should be changed in December for this benchmark assessment. So that is not within their terms of reference to make changes to it or to consider making changes to it. I think that Dr. Karp's view on this would be let's focus on getting these benchmark assessments done as best we can and see what comes out from those assessments. That'll be one piece of the puzzle. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to go forward with the stock ID thing, but I think trying to do both of them simultaneously simply isn't possible due to the amount of work and the short amount of time to get them both done simultaneously. So that, I think that's how I see it playing out. It will follow, but it won't be part of this December's meeting, at least not in a big way.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to be brief. I did have an opportunity to speak with Dr. Karp about the Herring Acoustic Survey and what the plan is for next year. And my only concern about that is that, you know, once a survey drops off the list for funding, will it ever come back? But I guess that's always, you know, an issue. I do think that taking a step back and reevaluating the status of that survey and, you know, the information it provides us is very good. It raises a lot of questions about stock structure and, you know, is it really, are we covering an area that is going to provide, you know, good input for the assessment? But my just one quick question is I was wondering if the center had a process in mind for reviewing the status of the survey, you know, next year, or is that still up for discussion?
I don't really know much about the future of the acoustic survey. When I announced that there was going to be a year off to reevaluate things, that's about the extent of what I know about it. So I don't know what plans are being made to do that reevaluation or plans for reinstating it or what vessel or anything.
John Bullard, last word on this issue.
Hi, Jim. Thanks. I just want to say something that underlines a comment that Laura made, and I don't speak so much as the regional administrator as wanting to forward comments that I've heard at a number of the listening sessions, particularly in Galilee and New Bedford, and that is about the side-by-side towing that Laura mentioned. And to have you take back that offer that people have made, who have expressed extreme, and I use that word carefully, skepticism of the Bigelow's inability under any circumstances to ever catch a yellowtail if someone dropped it in the net. I understand you're saying that, you know, that adjustments were made between the Bigelow and the Albatross. And people are offering to do side by side with industry vessels so that similar adjustments could be made with boats who say that they in fact can go right next to the Bigelow and get yellowtail so that similar adjustments could be made and ratios developed. And so I just want you to, and again, I'm not speaking for myself. I just want to forward that offer from people, especially in those two ports, to say you could make similar adjustments with that. They stand ready to offer that. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, John. I appreciate those comments, and I don't want anyone to think that we're trying to brush people off. But I'd like to repeat one old argument that I think is forgotten a lot of times. The Bigelow, we admit that the Bigelow does not catch every fish, and the efficiency of the Bigelow on every species is not going to be as good as a commercial fishing boat that has its gear tuned to target a particular species. We admit that. The goal of doing a survey with a survey vessel is to have a general tool that samples most of the species pretty well and, most importantly, on a consistent basis. So it's not how many fish you catch, but it's the consistency of the signal that really matters here. And in designing the survey gear and choosing things, those were the main considerations. So I often hear that we don't catch as many fish as a commercial boat, but keep in mind that we agree that it doesn't do that, and that doesn't invalidate the legitimacy of the science that's in the survey.
Okay, we're going to move on. Laura?
I don't talk that much, but give me one chance. I would just come back with the fact that while I understand from multiple groundfish meetings that the Bigelow's design is a soup ladle approach, that when we have to sit at the table across from the Canadians and talk about how many yellowtail are actually in the ocean, and we're not using gear designed to catch yellowtail, and we're being asked as managers to set numbers based on specific species, not based on an overview look, that it might behoove us, especially on this species, to get a better sense of what's in the ocean.
We're going to move on to Mid-Atlantic Liaison. Frank Blum.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid-Atlantic Council met in Philadelphia in mid-August. They met jointly with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission boards on summer flounder, scup, black sea bass, and bluefish. The council recommended the summer flounder specifications for a two-year period, 2013 and 14, realizing that there's going to be a benchmark assessment in 2013. Commercial quota recreational harvest limits were set at roughly 11.4 million pounds for commercial and roughly 7.6 for recreational for the two-year period. The council on all three species did not recommend any changes to the commercial minimum size or the commercial mesh sizes. And on all three of those species, the recreational measures will be set at the December meeting. For scup, the council recommended a three-year period, specification for 3 years, starting at 23 million pounds commercial for next year and going down to 20.6 million pounds in 2015, and recreational at 7.5 down to 6.6. Black sea bass, because of the uncertainty, they only set one-year specifications of 2013 of roughly 1.8 for commercial, 1.85 for recreational. Let's see. The council reviewed the Amendment 17 draft of the Summer Flounder Scup Black Sea Bass FMP, which dealt with the regional approach to management tools for the recreational black sea bass fishery, and they decided to send it back to staff for additional alternatives. Received a report on the scup allocation, and basically, I'll put it in a few words, said there's so many scup right now they couldn't determine the optimum allocation splits. I'll put the exact words was, due to recent large increases in the allowable harvest level of scup, it was unable to derive optimum allocations. So kind of going back to the drawing board. They decided to start a scup allocation amendment, which will investigate the potential of splitting the commercial recreational allocation as well as the summer, winter one and winter two in the commercial fishery. There was some, that was a tie vote that was broken by the chair, but that will move forward. Under bluefish, the council set 2 years. specifications. There is a decrease in the bluefish landings because of a weak year class, actually a couple weak year classes. And the commercial quota will be roughly 9.4, recreational 14.5, and then going down the following year by roughly 500,000 pounds on the commercial side. Spiny dogfish, the council approved the draft amendment to Amendment 3, addresses research set aside and allowing doing the essential fish habitat. We'll have a dogfish discussion, I believe, tomorrow. Later today, so I'll let that go. The council is going to hold a squid summit sometime, probably in December, to see if there's a better way to regulate and manage the squid fishery. So they'll have a meeting in December, probably followed up by another meeting sometime in early, after the beginning of the year. The council also had a meeting, actually, more of a webinar to discuss the butterfish cap. I was not part of that. I'll leave that to somebody else if they want to give the details. And that was basically most of the items. And if there's any questions, I'm also going to have a motion to make after this. So are there any questions?
Are there questions of Frank's report? Frank, Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. When there was discussion of allocation of SCUP, was it only allocation between the recreational commercial, or was there talk of allocation among states and have states allocation?
That was just recreational commercial and in between the winter periods. I don't believe there was any.
Anything else for Frank? Frank, I know that you and I had discussed whether this motion should come at this time. I'm going to ask you maybe if we can park that until we get through the reports. We'll see where we are. We've got a little open time right after lunch, and maybe we could start off with that motion at that point. But at least we will get through all of these reports, the other reports, before lunch.
Fine.
Okay. NOAA enforcement VMS. I see Bill is. I didn't see. Oh, there's Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Logan Gregory, Special Agent Charge, Northeast Division, Office of Law Enforcement. Submitted a quarterly report to the council earlier this week. It should be in the binders. I will just go through a few items in the report just for highlights. Since our last reporting, there were 35 documented incidents of outreach to industry, including mediating gear conflicts, contacting dealers and vessel owners and operators on reporting issues, creating a new laminated guide for Mid-Atlantic recreational and charter party fishery, and others. These instances, however, do not include the number of instances that the VMS team interacts with the fishing industry on a regular basis and daily, or the interaction between our officers and agents out in the field. A lot of that information is not captured in our reporting records management system, just mainly due to sheer volume of those records. Going through the investigations, after a 7-week trial in federal court in New Jersey, several individuals and two corporations were found guilty of felony counts to falsify records used by the FDA for tracking and movement of oysters in interstate commerce, and also for creating false records for illegally harvested and processed oysters, and guilty of conspiracy to commit those offenses and to obstruct justice. I don't have any information on when sentencing would be for this particular case, but it should be in the next few months. Also recently, Richard Wetherell was convicted of two counts of assault and harassment of observers. That was a criminal case that occurred in Boston. Sentencing Scott has not been scheduled yet in that case either. Magnuson Act cases, we've had a few instances of noncompliance from a gillnet fisherman failing to allow observers the opportunity to complete their required pre-deployment safety inspection. We were able to mitigate that issue, and the individual was, the observer was able to complete their safety inspection prior to the vessel departing. No enforcement action was taken. We have completed 14 right whale speed rule investigations that have been forwarded to the Office of General Counsel, and we are continuing to investigate 4 humpback whale entanglements that happened back in July. Going to page 5 in the Observer Program, during the first 6 months of calendar year 12, 99% of all selected observed trips were completed without reported incident to enforcement, which is good. I think some of our enforcement efforts in that regard to ensure the safety of the observers has helped with that. So far this year, we have received approximately 57 complaints from the Observer Program. During that same period in 2011, we received 78 complaints, so complaints are down, which is also good. The complaints involve, there was 1 harassment complaint, 5 interference complaints, 11 intimidation complaints, 3 refusal complaints, 21 complaints involving safety issues, or 16 involving safety issues, sorry. We've done a number of outreach events with our state partners and with Canada DFO. We're still spooling up a lot of information and collecting a lot of information, trying to analyze where the majority of the issues are so that we can be more focused on and targeting real problems and mitigating problems that can be mitigated without enforcement action. The back of the report has some statistical information regarding incidents. Incidents are not always enforcement actions. They could just simply be a boarding or an inspection of a dealer where no enforcement action is taken. You can see from 2011 to 2012, we have a significant increase in inspections, and that's mainly due to the addition of our enforcement officer program. We currently have 5 enforcement officers in the Northeast Division, and we will be looking to hire an enforcement officer supervisor, hopefully, in fiscal year 13 to manage that program and to increase it. You can see the dispositions for incidents. The majority of them have been completed for 2012. Again, those are mainly because those are incidents that don't involve any type of enforcement action. It's just meeting the industry, conducting boardings and investigation and inspections of dealers and vessels. So that concludes my portion of the report, and I'll turn it over to Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, council members. It's good to be here. Again, I'm Bill Semro, the Northeast VMS Program Manager within NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement. The Northeast VMS team is monitoring 1,041 active vessels. And at the June Council meeting, I provided a summary of changes under development to the VMS software installed on Northeast vessels. The changes are primarily in support of 2 VMS-related sector exemptions approved by the Regional Office for the 2012 fishing year. They are specifically Sector Exemption 17, which provides additional flexibility that allows exempted sector vessels to declare and fish both inside and outside the closed Area 1 hook gear haddock sap on the same trip, and Sector Exemption 20, which allows exempted sector vessels to declare at sea and fish in the eastern U.S.-Canada sap and closed Area 2 yellowtail flounder haddock sap. These changes are also driving related changes to the monkfish declaration screen. In addition to translating the exemptions into VMS declaration changes, the collaborative effort between the Northeast VMS team and the region's SFD staff separated the groundfish declaration menu into sector and common pool menus. We also found it necessary to completely revamp the area selection menu that required the fishermen to declare one or more of the U.S.-Canada management sub-areas 1 through 8. These often confusing area combinations of the regular access program, the eastern and western U.S.-Canada areas, the eastern SAP and the closed area 2 SAP, no longer provide enough area flexibility called for in the sector exemption rule. The new software simply requires the fishermen to choose from a menu of areas by name, which the software then translates into an abbreviated area identifier within the VMS code. Our target date for release of the new software was to be September 1. However, the development was more complex than we had originally thought, and the original documentation provided to the VMS vendors required some changes. The complexity of the change is evident in the number of valid VMS declarations or codes from the current 2,700 to about 8,200. Currently, testing of the SkyMate software is about 90% complete, while BoatTrax macro testing is about 50% complete, and the Tron software testing hasn't yet started, but we expect to commence testing upon receipt of the software next Monday. Realistically, I expect to have the new software available for release by early November. I recognize this is about a 60-day delay from the original target, but I'd rather deliver accurate software late than one with bugs on time. Once the software is released, it's much harder and costlier at that point to change it. Two other quick topics as well. OLE headquarters has initiated a project to revise and consolidate the type approval requirements for VMS units and their associated communication service providers. The requirements need to be more clearly defined so that we have an improved ability to hold vendors accountable when not meeting standards. One area that I will be particularly focused on is the latency requirement, which is vital to the Northeast VMS program. My comments are due by October 1. Finally, I've been testing a new unit called the Thorium VMS, developed by a French company, CLS. They have their American affiliate in Maryland. The Thorium uses the Iridium satellite network, and it's been approved in other regions. The biggest hurdle is getting the new Northeast software right. I've looked at their first attempt at the software, and they're clearly on the right track. I anticipate making a recommendation decision for type approval within the next few months. Mr. Chairman, this completes my report. Be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Logan or Bill? Dave?
Yeah, Bill, the latency issue, that's the time delay between when you send something and when you get an acknowledgement. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. It's still occurring. It seems to be, it's somehow calendar related. We seem to go through a week every month where, I don't know. I mean, I know back in, I think it was early September, I'd say somewhere between a half hour and 2 hours to get an acknowledgement. And then recently we're down to, you know, a matter of minutes. So, you know, just for your comments, that seems to be an ongoing and continuing issue that's somehow calendar driven.
You're right, Dave. It is. And I believe it's, again, related to the satellite network that SkyMate uses, Orbcom. And the, you know, the problems with one of their planes. And so it's cyclic. Every, you know, several weeks, there's going to be a period of time there where the latency is going to be worse. Because if that particular satellite plane is overhead that you're using, because they had to spread out the satellites, there's, you know, it's going to cause increased latency. So until they can get more satellites in the air, I think that's going to continue to be a problem. But our latency standards in the type approval documents that we have, I believe they're not as clearly defined as they should be. Without getting into those details, I think there's a way to make it tighter, and that's what I'll be looking to do. Thanks.
Thank you for that report. Peter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, looking ahead in the future, if groundfish closures are modified, how much time, if any, will you need to adjust with the software and what you might do with Logan?
Yeah, that's a good question, Peter. This software change, of all the changes I've done, and we've probably done a dozen over the years, has clearly been the most challenging. But I've got the benefit of a VMS programmer on staff now, so a lot of the things that we might have done, you know, manually in the past, we're automating. And so I think once we get through this change, we're going to have our processes much more automated and be able to put them out quicker. We really, to be frank, we didn't have much planning time. We need to know in advance when an exemption is going to be granted. You know, for example, when we rolled out the changes for Amendment 16 back in May of 2010 timeframe, April, we needed several months to do that. So, you know, it really depends on what the change is. In some cases, it could be very, very simple and fairly quick. But remember, these changes are costly. You know, I would say we're talking several tens of thousands of dollars that the vendors charge to roll out one software change. And that's why I've mentioned to the council in the past, I know this is difficult to do, is to try and package these software changes. You know, we've been lucky. I think we've only done maybe a maximum of two a year. You know, I think if we can get away with one a year, that would be even better. But I realize that it's not easy to do, you know, because you're looking at FMPs, you know, maybe in more, I don't know if stovepiped is the right term, but, you know, we're not always able to package and bundle them together. But I think ideally, in terms of cost and maybe less confusion to the fishermen who have to use the software, you know, you try to minimize the number of changes.
Is it possible to do it offline? We're running behind. We've got a couple more things we've got to get done, hopefully before lunch. Hogan?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, before we conclude the enforcement report, I'd like to bring Frank Spertel up from the Office of General Counsel Enforcement Section so he can bring the council up to speed on what's been occurring in the enforcement section.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. My name is Frank Spertel. I'm an attorney with the NOAA Office of General Counsel, Enforcement Section in Silver Spring, Maryland. I've been assigned to handle Northeast Region issues during this interim period. There's been a lot of things that have happened during since the council met last. In terms of the Office of General Counsel, we have a new Enforcement Section Chief. His name is Jim Landon. Jim comes to us from he served as the Deputy General Counsel of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he supervised 45 employees and provided legal counsel on, among other things, environmental law and compliance issues with a focus on NEPA, ESA, and Clean Water Act matters. He was there for 14 years was assigned a number of different responsibilities at the FBI. He is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. He holds a master's degree in international affairs from George Washington University, a certificate in international law from Oxford University, and a JD, Juris Doctor degree from George Washington University. Jim started with us on July 30th of this year, and he's been a welcome addition. We also have had approval of our Northeast Region backlog of old cases approved earlier this year. I'm happy to report that most of those cases have been adjudicated. There's a few that are outstanding, and we're working hard to resolve those. Along with the backlog of older cases, if you will, we continue to issue new notice of violation assessments and written warnings for violations documented in the Northeast region. Signed on July 26th of this year was a memorandum of understanding with the Coast Guard Judge Advocate General. This was designed to assist the enforcement section with Coast Guard-generated cases. Coast Guard JAGs will be assigned to work underneath those of us in the enforcement section in adjudicating cases. They will make recommendations to us, and we'll work closely with them in terms of deciding on how to adjudicate those cases. So that's a really positive development, and that'll be a real benefit to all of us, I think. And lastly, I'm happy to report that we have approval to hire two new enforcement attorneys that will be, I'm told, placed in the Northeast region in the Gloucester office. It's unclear when those positions will be announced, but we've gotten approval to hire two new folks, so that will help facilitate things. That's all that I have. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any? Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The the two attorneys that would come to Gloucester, would that then allow them to deal with the council and not Silver Spring, and on a routine basis to interact with the attorneys? And two, those Coast Guard legal officers, would they be from District 1 or would they be from Washington that would deal with the cases?
Thanks for your question. The two attorneys that will be assigned in the Northeast region will be handling, I'm guessing, Northeast matters. So they'll be coming to council meetings, enforcement committee meetings, and other meetings that traditionally we've covered in the past. In terms of the Coast Guard folks, it's from District 1. We have two JAGs that have been assigned to work with us, but it'll be from the First District.
Okay. On to a brief ASMFC report. David Pierce.
Of course, Mr. Chairman. The Atlantic Sea Herring Section met at the ASMFC meeting, and we received the sea herring assessment information from the center. Obviously, we're going to focus on that particular assessment tomorrow during one of the committee reports. Actually, I believe it's a report of the last SARC, the 54th workshop, SARC assessment workshop. And it'll be quite revealing for all council members to see how indeed the assessment was handled and how it dealt with some of the ecosystem concerns that we all have about the importance of sea herring as a prey species. So you'll receive a very thorough and entertaining assessment summary tomorrow. We also spent quite a bit of time talking about the specific initiatives that the states, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, has taken to support the New England Council, notably the spawning protection that we afford for sea herring in the Gulf of Maine. The states have spawning closures that affect federal permit holders as well as state permit holders. We decided to modify the way in which we determine if the fish are spawning, acting on some technical committee advice, so that that is being done to make the spawning closure even more effective than it is right now. Days out, as you all know, the state set landings days for sea herring in the inshore portion of the Gulf of Maine. That's how the councils and the ASMFC sea herring quota in the inshore portion of the Gulf is managed. And the states meet, Maine, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. We meet quite often, discuss quite often with the industry how to restrict effort, and we've done so rather successfully over the last few years. I'll just highlight that for the first time ever, we had a disagreement, and this disagreement was reflected actually last week at the sea herring meeting, the council's meeting, when the three states met and talked about landing days. Come October 1st, when the second part of the quota for the Area 1A is implemented, we will have every day as a landing day. There was a disagreement between Massachusetts and the other states. Some would say no big deal, but still, it's the first time we had a disagreement. So we expect, I think, that the quota that kicks in on October 1 will be taken relatively quickly because there will be no landing days off. So that summarizes what happened with sea herring progress. With regards to winter flounder,
the
the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission has a winter flounder management board. It's been in place for a long time. And for all these years, we focused primarily on the recreational fishery and how to deal with its proper management to be consistent with what the council has been attempting to do with winter flounder, again, over the years. We don't have a winter, we don't have a board that reflects interest in other groundfish species. Maybe that will happen down the road, but for now it's only winter flounder. And what we did do, the board, was respond to the stock status information on Gulf of Maine winter flounder. And as a consequence of that, the increase in the ACL that doubled again for the 2012 fishing year, we are proposing through an addendum that's going to go to public hearing that we actually increase the landing limit for winter flounder somewhat, not in a dramatic amount, 250 up to 500 pounds. And we'll be expanding if we all decide to do this. Again, it will be decided end of this month when ASMFC meets, that is October. We will decide whether or not to increase the landing limit and then to expand the recreational season year-round. We await some recommendations, some findings from the technical committee that has and is reviewing the specific addendum. And I'll quickly highlight that this is being done with an understanding that the states do have a responsibility to do what needs to be done inside state waters, affecting non-federal permit holders to constrain catch of groundfish that are in our waters that are caught by non-federal permit holders. So we're doing this with winter flounder, proposing an increase, and it suggests, therefore, well, not suggest, it clearly indicates that the states are being sensitive to the different ACLs that are established by the council on different groundfish species. So you can expect further work on these groundfish species caught by non-federal permit holders come, if not before, then shortly after May 1, 2013, with all of the changes in the ACLs, especially the decreases in the ACLs. So, and by the way, you did receive last time around, I think, last council meeting, maybe it was in the interim period, a letter from the Commonwealth from the Division of Marine Fisheries regarding our response to the chair's expressed concerns about what are the states doing to deal with the ACLs. So that response was provided to the chair, and I hope you've all had a chance to take a look at that. The other issue that may be of concern, I suspect it is, sturgeon. Sturgeon has reared its head. I wouldn't say its ugly head. Well, then again, it is kind of an ugly fish. It has reared its ugly head. We have given, that is, the Sturgeon Board of ASMFC, we've given the sturgeon assessment top priority. Stock assessment is a top priority for 2013. And we do that in part because of what the National Marine Fisheries Service has done with sturgeon, that is, the listing, which has created all sorts of interesting problems for us, that is, this council, and certainly for ASMFC. I think without exception, every state, maybe there's one exception, I'm not sure now. I'll say without exception, all the ASMFC states have disagreed with what the National Marine Fisheries Service has done, and we have charged our technical committee to develop a draft delisting, downlisting petition, which will be considered by the Sturgeon Board at our meeting at the end of October. Again, we don't agree with what the service has done. And now we have to explain why, and that will happen through the technical work that we will be doing and, of course, the stock assessment that will be done. And let's see here. I will highlight only one other thing. Okay. Yes, dogfish. Dogfish will be discussed later on this afternoon, but I should point out that we did decide, that is the board, the dogfish board, did decide to continue with our status quo of a maximum of a 5% rollover per year of the quota as long as the stock biomass is above the target, and it is. This is an issue that may be raised by some members of this council when we get to the dogfish discussion because rollovers are allowed in other stocks, so perhaps the council should consider that for the spiny dogfish fishery too. And then finally on dogfish, we did decide to adopt we voted to adopt all of the updated overfishing definitions the overfishing definitions consistent with the federal plan so that we're all on the same page. Obviously, it's an important thing for us to do, to be on the same page, and we have done that. So that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman, and there are other board members, other ASMFC members around the table who may want to add anything that I might have forgotten.
Perry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be brief. There's one additional report to add on Northern Shrimp. The public hearings for a draft addendum 1 begin next week. This addendum contains a number of new management options, including the potential for state-by-state and gear-type allocations, as well as trawl gear modifications to reduce the catch of small shrimp. Very compressed timeline. The public comment period ends on the 17th of October, and there will be two section meetings scheduled in November, one to vote on the measures, the new management measures, and the second to set the season for next year.
Paul, and then we are going to move on.
The mention of winter flounder in increasing the landing limits and the seasonality, is that consistent with the federal plan? In other words, are the landings of winter flounder going to go up with ASMFC? That means the federal landings will have to go down? Or is what the ASMFC doing consistent with the federal plan?
Yeah, we'll be consistent. That's why the technical committee is taking a close look at this, with an understanding that if indeed what we are proposing to do will in some way have us cross that threshold of the specific state waters allocation, the sub-ACL, then we'd have to back away from that. We certainly do not want to put the federal permit holders in a difficult position of having to lose fish because it's been reallocated in a way. Although I'll be quick to highlight that the National Marine Fisheries Service did, through recent action, remove quite a bit of Gulf of Maine codfish from the state waters ACL subcomponent to give to the federal permit holders. And that was done without consultation with any of the states. We don't object to it, obviously, because of the situation with Gulf of Maine cod and the need to deal with low ACLs. But that needs to be remembered that action was taken. So any criticism of the states regarding what we do inside state waters might need to be tempered by, you know, what has happened with Gulf of Maine cod and what could happen in the future as we deal with our rather desperate situation with groundfish.
Thank you. Northeast Regional Ocean Council, John Weber. I'm just doing that for the people online.
And am I correct in assuming I'm standing or sitting between you and lunch?
No, between us and the new First District Commander.
Ah, even more so. So, boy, you will watch this go from 0 to 60 in a hurry. So thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Weber, the Ocean Planning Director for the Northeast Regional Ocean Council. Two quick things. As most of you know who have seen me give updates before, we have multiple projects ongoing. The one I really want to focus in on with you now is our fisheries mapping project that we have underway. To give you an update on that, we have obtained the vessel trip report data and vessel monitoring system data, both from NOAA, so thanks to Bill Semrau and John Witzig and others in the Gloucester office for their help on this. We have obtained that data, and we have processed it basically to the point where we can display it on charts. Where we are, that has been happened over the summer. Where we are now is that we have, working with our partners on this project, which include George LaPointe here in the room, folks from the Island Institute, and folks from the Rhode Island Coastal Resources Commission, I believe. We have had a series of meetings throughout New England with several of the folks in this room and others not in this room today to really do two things. One is just very preliminarily starting to look at all the data that we have and starting to sift through it and what makes sense, how do we organize it. Let's talk about how we display some basic questions on how to display it. Importantly, also identifying gaps in information that we have. That's been a key part of the conversation that we've had with some folks to date. But also there's another key part, which has to do with asking for advice and input on how to more robustly engage going forward, because our intent is that throughout the rest of 2012 and heading on into 2013, we want to build on these initial meetings, which will be continuing for the next couple of weeks or so, and develop a more robust, refined essentially plan for engaging industry, scientists, and managers. So basically we're talking with folks right now to get input onto exactly how do we do that, recognizing that this is a big question and there are lots of details to get into there. I would categorize the information that we've, or input we've received so far as extraordinarily helpful. Here's a couple of examples. In talking with many folks, the need to do things like if you're going to show a map with fishing data on it, you also, to explain in part what you're looking at, you need to have illustrations of management measures, i.e. closure areas, other spatial management measures, and a description of things like when gear restrictions may have gone into place, because obviously that plays a big role in telling the story of what it is that you're looking at. So thanks to Michelle Bachman, Chris Kendall, and other folks from the council staff who have worked with us to do things like get that GIS data to us so that we can incorporate that. A couple of other just examples of types of things we're thinking about. One has to do with if you're going to go do this across New England, which we are, what is the appropriate scale of geography to display this data? Probably there are multiple answers to that, but we're very interested in that question. In general, I would say, how do we illustrate a lot of the nuance that maybe gets that is very important to unearth in our conversations as we're looking at this data? So there's a lot more to come with that. Importantly, just so that folks know, we are also very interested in any and all opportunities to raise awareness of this project. We think that's very important. We'll be having a booth at the Working Waterfront Festival this weekend in New Bedford. We are actively pursuing getting publications in a couple of publications in the region, just as an example, in addition to additional meetings to come later on in the year in 2013. In general, what I would say is that this is also, we are having a parallel approach with some of our other work, engaging with some of the other constituencies out there in terms of developing baseline data and starting to talk about these issues and concerns that we all have with other stakeholders from energy, ports and shipping, recreational boating, natural resources, et cetera. Finally, and most importantly, I would say for right now, is I do want to make sure that people have on their calendars, and I noted it's on the Fishery Council calendar, so thank you for that. November 19th and November 20th is going to be the first meeting of the regional planning body, and that is the entity under this framework that we're working with at federal level, which is going to have responsibility for developing this regional plan going forward. That meeting is going to be at the University of Southern Maine. I think it is this big auditorium there. I think it's called the Hannaford Auditorium. Notice of that has been sent out fairly broadly, but certainly please see me. I'll be around for a while and or check our website for more details on that. There will be more details to come in terms of things like an agenda. The meeting will be open to the public. I think the idea right now is that on the 19th is about half a day and a full day on the 20th. Just to give you an overview of what the agenda, I think, is going to include, certainly an overview of ongoing work as along the lines of what I've just discussed, but in more detail. There will certainly have to be a part in terms of just nuts and bolts of the regional planning body process, but also importantly, I think there's going to be a start to the overall discussion of things like goals and objectives of this work. And, Mr. Chair, that's my report, and happy to answer any questions, and or I will be around for a little while.
John Bullard.
John, it's good to see you here. This is my first meeting, but you and I have worked together on marine spatial planning for a long time, as you know. So I don't know if you come to these meetings all the time or not. You've been at 100% of the fishery management meetings that I've been at. So this is great. I want to say to the council that I'm a big fan of John Weber and the work that he does. And I've been critical of the process of ocean planning when it it sometimes treats fishery management as an afterthought and reaches out to fishermen and people who deal with fishery management after it reaches out to everyone else. And so it's really great to see John here before the New England Fishery Management Council. And I'm glad you're here. And I also want to say to the council that as John comes here to us, I hope that we respond in kind and work with the Northeast Regional Ocean Council, because I think there's an awful lot that we can do together. I think whether it's issues of how do we assemble the data that we have. I mean, I'm just blown away by your effort, John, to assemble data that different agencies have so that decisions on whether it's siting wind turbines or changing channels for shipping lanes to protect against ship strikes, whatever or whatever the decisions are that have to be made, the mapping that's going on so that we can make better decisions, the assembly of data that you're doing is just going to make for better decisions, and so that work is important. Obviously, it affects the kind of decisions we're making as we look at similar issues about omnibus habitat areas and whether or not we should be considering opening areas. So I think that I'm glad you're here. I hope we find many ways, not just with the council, but also with the Northeast Regional Office, where our communications are in a regular basis, and the sharing of information is in a regular basis, because I've also gotten interactions from fishermen about, you know, what role do we play when people make decisions off of Block Island or other places about the siting of wind turbines and how that might affect our ability to tow mobile gear, or the impacts that gear may have on our ability to fish. So the early and frequent communication between decision-making, both between your efforts and people affected by your efforts, fishermen and people who help manage fishermen, i.e. people around this table, is important. I'm delighted, John, as you know, someone who's worked with you for many years, to have you here, and I hope we'll see a lot of you, both in informal meetings like this and in day-to-day decision-making. Good to see you here.
John, just to update you, the council agrees with all of your thoughts concerning the Northeast Regional Ocean Council. We have made room for John to present to us on a routine basis at the council meetings. If there are issues that are more substantial, then we will work out something else. And we have a representative member on the council. So thank you very much, John. And now I would like to turn the meeting over to the Coast Guard for their report on activities and get some remarks from the new district commander. Before I do that, I would like to say welcome aboard to Admiral Abel, and also to say thank you to you for 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 you to you